Yeah, folks, the guys at IBM.TV thought it was real fun to have a radio guy doing television and all of that. So, a number of things are happening around the world, of course. I know a number of folks are following what's going on in sports. And even though we're seeing that it's happening in a bubble, we do have two teams that are in the finals, that being the Lakers and Miami. I know a lot of folks are thinking that it's going to be the Lakers all the way. And with all that firepower, they are probably right. But hey, that doesn't mean that Miami will not give it that good old-fashioned try. And I do not count anybody out. And particularly since they've got two Marquette players that are on the team. And as y'all know, I am a Marquette grad. So Jimmy Butler is on the team, as is Jay Crowder. So a number of folks that may decide that they want to change things in terms of who's favored or not favored. And speaking of things that are going on in that sense of who's favored and not favored, we do have a debate coming up as well. That'll be on Tuesday. That's right. This coming, well, tomorrow, there'll be that debate between Joe Biden and the current president that's sitting in the office, Mr. Trump, and we'll see how that debate turns out. That's the first of a few debates that they have scheduled on the plate. So we'll see how that all turns out and who wins that debate. But it should be quite interesting to see how that plays out as well. And of course, a number of folks are concerned about things like the what's going on with the current pandemic that is terrorizing the entire world, actually. And a lot of folks are very much concerned about that and trying to figure out when a vaccine will come out or what other kinds of methods of healing that can be done as the world just tries to cope with this very devastating thing that has taken place in the world. And of course, we know that the folks out in California are dealing with the wildfires. I know that one of my cohorts here on IBM.TV did a fundraiser for those wildfire victims on this past weekend, and I'm hoping that he raised quite a bit of money, because as he was pointing out, there were a number of musicians and others that had lost some things that were very valuable to them. So that's some of the things that are happening in the world, and definitely looking forward to an engaging conversation with my guests and everything. So I'm going to bring up the first one, that being none other than Mr. Ira David Wood. And Ira, I've known for a while. He is a master person in the theater world here in the Durham area. And some people may know even more some of the folks that are in his family. But definitely, he's been doing a lot of things. I know that I have seen The Christmas Carol a couple of times, and he actually even sometimes brings up the political aspect. But unfortunately, because of the virus, I doubt very seriously that we're going to see that this year, unless we see a virtual version of it. So that's maybe one of the first questions I can ask Ira. So Ira, how are you doing? How are things going? And what's happening in your world? I know you're sitting at home and you're trying to relax, but I know that you're always got theater on your mind as well. So how are things going? And can we expect to see a Christmas Carol? I know it's only fall, but we started off fall a couple of days ago, but folks are already thinking about that show that you do every year. And like I said, I know that with the virus and so many theater productions haven't been canceled, that a lot of folks are probably even wondering whether there will be a version or whether it'll be a virtual version. So what's the word right now?
The word right now, Mark Lee, my main man, is it's good to see you. Yes, Virginia, there will be a Christmas Carol this year. We are going virtual. We're going to be streaming. Right now, the plans are to stream last year's full version of the show, beginning December 1st and running through December the 25th. It'll be a pay-per-view enterprise and a fundraiser for the theater, just like this production always is every year. Right. So we're looking forward to it, and we're also putting together a package deal where you'll be able to download and see a video that is currently up on Amazon, which is called An Evening with Scrooge and Marley. It was David Henderson and I in the theater with a live audience, just reminiscing and telling lies about the show, having fun. We're also putting together a Christmas Carol video scrapbook because in 47 years, we've collected a lot of video on stage and behind the scenes. Some of that is hysterical. But it includes the tours to France and to England. So I think people will get a good dose of Christmas Carol this year. We're looking forward to it.
It sounds great. I know I'm looking forward to it. I always do look forward to that. One of the things that I've always enjoyed about your shows is that you're not afraid to tackle some political jokes in there as well. So I know there were some in the one that I saw a couple of years ago. So can we expect some zingers on some of our politicians to be in there as well?
Absolutely. I think one of the things we said this year was in the office scene with Scrooge and Bob Cratchit, Scrooge is going to keep safe distancing Cratchit until he's out in the street and has to yell all the way on stage to be heard. Yeah, we're going to have a little fun with that. And but again, you know, I've always said, look, there's so much news right now, not all of it good, spilling into our living rooms every day. I think in a big way, people want a break. So we hit a few things and we know that'll get a laugh and keep it current. But it's all about Christmas this year. And if we've ever needed Christmas and the holiday season and everything that comes with that, boy, we need it this year. So we're just looking forward to taking people's minds off of problems and isolation and depression and putting some joy and good spirits back in people's hearts. That's the whole thing this year. So we hope everybody will join us. There's information to be had about the streaming on the theater's website, which is www.theaterinthepark.com. We spell it theater with an R-E. We don't spell it theater, okay? So, yeah, it's theaterinthepark.com. If you go there, you'll get all the information you need about the streaming version. And we'll be doing email blasts and advertising it all over the place. I'll be coming to people's homes just to do it. Stand on the doorstep with my mask on and do the whole show, Mark. So stand by.
Sounds good. I'll be waiting for you. I got an apartment complex. I'll bring all my apartment neighbors, and we can just have a private version of it right here in the apartment complex. So that'll be a great thing. Now, we've got a worldwide audience here, and I know a lot of folks know you here in the North Carolina area, but if you would just tell people a little bit about your theater background for some of my folks that are watching from as far away as Australia and South Africa and other places that might be interested in knowing how Ira got involved in the world of theater, and it seems to be a family affair. Like I said, I know that your son is also involved. Your daughter is, of course, very well known as a Hollywood actress and everything, but would love to know how you got involved in the world of theater at first.
Well, I came from a rural background. I'm from a very rural county in the northeastern part of the state, Halifax County. When I went to school, I was a future pharma of America, not by choice. That's just what you did. And when I was in high school, all the guys had to take vocational agriculture. All the girls had to take home ec. And those that weren't sure took both just to cover the bases. and you were expected basically to be a farmer, to grow up and to stay in the area. That didn't go down too well with me. I went out for sports, but in my high school years, I looked like a Biafran refugee. I really did. So if I dressed up in the football uniform and put the pads on, I just looked normal. And I sat on the sidelines most of the season. They sent me in once, and the coach looked at me. He was in tears because the first string had been slaughtered in the first 15 minutes of the game. I was the only one left. He looked at me with tears in his eyes. He said, "Wood, you got to go in." I said, "Coach, I'll get grass stains on my uniform." But I went in and did the best I could. But I guess I was always the class show off. I was always the one who was putting on skits, putting on plays. We didn't have a drama club, so one day the guidance counselor came to me and he said, "David, I think you belong in a place with other crazy people like yourself." And I said, "Where would that be?" And he said, "There's a place called Governor School, which takes kids from all over the state of North Carolina who are interested in various subjects, mathematics, science, the arts." There were only two books in our high school library on theater, and I checked both of them out and culled a monologue from between the two books. auditioned for governor's school. To my absolute surprise, I made it. I spent my summer in Winston-Salem on the campus of Salem College, where governor's school was held that year. And it really turned my life around. I knew I wanted to continue. And luckily for me, this wonderful Italian man came and spoke to us while I was at governor's school. His name was Vittorio Giannini. And he was talking about this new school that was going to open in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. It was going to be the first school of its kind in the Western Hemisphere that taught dance, music, drama, and academics under the same roof. It sounded incredible. And it was the North Carolina School of the Arts. And it opened in 1965. I took those same two theater books and I did the same audition. And then I went back to my vocational agriculture class in Enfield, and I waited to find out if I'd been accepted. And one day the principal's voice came on the speaker in the classroom. He said, "David Wood, come to the office, please." And right away you just go, "Oh, what does he know? I'm in trouble." So I walked over to the main building and I was going down that long corridor in the school. And when I looked at the other end of the corridor, I saw my mom standing there. So I knew it was serious. I was ready for the blindfold and my last cigarette by the time I got to her. And I said, "Mom, what's wrong?" And she looked at me and she said, "Nothing. You've been accepted at the North Carolina School of the Arts. This is the last time I'll see you walk down this hallway." And I went back to my vocational agriculture class. My best friend leaned over and said, "What happened?" And I said, "I've been accepted at School of the Arts." He said, "What's that?" I said, "I don't know, but it's got to be better than vocational agriculture." So I attended the first year, my senior year in high school, at School of the Arts, brand new school. It changed my life. I found a square foot of universe that belonged to me. And I was suddenly with other young people my age who shared my love and my passion for the arts. I met so many incredible people. And I, when I graduated 5 years later, I had an invitation from Andy Griffith to come to the West Coast and join him on a series he was doing at the time called Headmaster. So I stopped off in Raleigh, waiting to head out in the fall of the year. And while I was here, I got a telephone call from the Department of Public Instruction. And a man's voice said, "I'm looking for a young man who wants to change the world and thinks theater is the way to do it." So I told him, I said, "Well, you got to give me 5 minutes. I need to call Andy Griffith on the West Coast," which I did. I thanked Andy for the invitation, but I said, "You know, I think it's very important that I stay here in North Carolina because this job is going to allow me to go out into schools all over the state and perhaps find people who were like me, who didn't fit in, who weren't able to express themselves and felt different in a negative way." And I was able to do that. I was able to go out into schools across the state, get drama departments started, drama clubs, dinner theaters going. And I was asked after a year with the Department of Public Instruction if I wanted to come and take over the directorship of the Raleigh Children's Theater. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Sure, I'd love to do that," because I felt kind of like a racehorse in a stable a little bit with the state job. And I said, "But I want to change the name of the children's theater. I want it to be a family theater." We didn't have a home. We were nomads. We kind of traveled around Raleigh and performed in different schools. And one day we stumbled upon a building in the northern end of Raleigh's historic Pullen Park. And it was an old armory building. And there were bars on the windows. It was a basketball court. It was a catch-all for a lot of dog obedience class, judo class, and astronomy class. But when I walked into that place, I said, "This is a theater," because our theater at School of the Arts was a gymnasium painted black, a black box theater is what we call it. So everything inside is movable. So when I saw the Pullen Park Armory, I said, gosh, this is home. So we really went to work with the Department of Parks and Recreation to get the building. We got it, and a friend of mine, dear friend, went in with me, and we took 60 gallons of black paint and an industrial paint sprayer and painted the interior of that building black. And because it was in Pullen Park, we decided to name it Theater in the Park. And that's where I've been now for years. And again, while we were stationed there and found that new home in Pullen Park, I noticed that all of the theaters were closed in Raleigh during the holiday season. And I said, well, this is strange, because the holidays are a time that families want to go out and do things together. Right. And we were doing a season of Shakespeare that year, 1974. And I said, well, Shakespeare didn't write a Christmas play, so let's go to the second best English author. And I thought that was Charles Dickens. And I said, let's do A Christmas Carol. Let's do our own version, make it a musical, and I want to make it a comedy. I want people to laugh and have fun. Because Dickens calls the story, you know, a ghost story. And Scrooge is just, you know, he's mean and morose and cold. And I said, I want people to identify with Scrooge, because I think there's a little Scrooge in everybody in December.
Yeah.
You know, because television tells us everything is perfect. You know, the house is clean. The turkey is just cooked perfectly. And it's not like that. It's a lot of stress and pressure. So I said, let's break it for people and just let them identify with Scrooge a little bit. If they laugh at Scrooge, it's easier for them to do that. And if they identify with Scrooge, then they're going to be able to identify with that little bit of Scrooge that's in them. And as Scrooge makes his transformation in the play, they'll make their transformation along with everybody in the show. And when they walk out, they're going to be happy. And it's going to be because the medicine doesn't have to taste bad to do good things. So that, in a nutshell, is how Theater in the Park got started, how A Christmas Carol got its wings. This will be the 47th year that we've done the show. I've got a few more years, maybe two or three more years with the show, and then I'll turn it over to my son, Ira David IV, who stepped in for me in 2010. I had to have open heart surgery, and that was a big shock. But thankfully, I had already blocked the show. It was all set and ready to go. But I called my son up and I said, stop by the house today. He walked in. I said, hello, Mr. Scrooge. And the color kind of drained out of his face. And he said, are you serious? I said, I'm as serious as a heart attack.
Wow.
So he stepped in. He did the show that year. I went in, had open heart surgery. They replaced my aortic valve. I have a pig's valve now in my heart, so I can root up truffles with the best of them. Eating barbecue at our house is a religious experience now.
I'm sure it is. I'm trying to figure out how you discovered the Fountain of Youth, because I've decided that both you and my dad, who is an artist at the age of 80, have somehow discovered the Fountain of Youth. So I'm still trying to figure out where y'all are hiding it at and why y'all won't release it to the rest of us, because I know that y'all are hiding it somewhere.
Well, I think it's waking up every day and being able to do something that you love. The first time I got a check for something I did in theater, I couldn't believe people would actually pay me for doing something that I would do on the street for free if that was the only way I could do it. So maybe your dad and I, you know, that's the other thing too. People used to say when I was little, what are you going to be when you grow up? And that's a daunting question for young people, particularly when you're small. And, you know, the pat answers are, well, I'm going to be a doctor, a lawyer, a policeman, you know. And they would ask me, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I'd look back at them and say, who says I got to grow up? I never did. I still play Cowboys and Indians. You know, I still enter my world of imagination, and I'm sure your dad does too.
Yeah.
So if it's the joy inside of you that keeps you going and keeps you young, and I tell you, it's finding a sense of humor.
Oh yeah.
And I tell you what, I'm lucky. I've got a wonderful wife. I think we laugh together every morning within 15 minutes of waking up.
Wow.
And that's been a blessing. So there are a lot of things I think that add to longevity, eating well, exercising, all of those things that we know we should do. But to be able to do something that we're passionate about and that we love, I think is one of those blessings that keeps us young and keeps us moving. Also, I have to say, I'm 73 this November, and I have a 7-year-old son. And if that doesn't keep you moving, I don't know what will.
Wow, you got a 7-year-old son. That'll definitely keep you moving for sure. I'm sure y'all were not expecting that. But, you know, I can expect some other things that folks are not always expecting, because you were talking about your athletic background and everything. Well, I had something similar. I tried to run track, and I was very bad at track. And I was also – and I know the stereotype within the African-American and other minority communities of being that great athlete, but also that great musician. And I tried to join the band, and guess what? I remember the band teacher coming back to me and saying, "Sorry, Mark, I know you're trying to play those drums. I know you're trying to do that, but I know the stereotype. You have no rhythm." But I'm supposed to have rhythm. It's DNA. And they were like, "Nope, no rhythm." So I can relate to what you're saying. I want to bring in one of our other guests as well. And he comes at it from another perspective. And Cheston Bolgen is joining us. He is a person that I know it's something that you have to deal with on a regular basis. He deals with bookkeeping and finances and stuff along those lines. So I know, Chester, you were listening in the background. I saw you back there just chuckling and enjoying the conversation. So tell folks a little bit about your business, and then I'll continue the conversation with both of y'all and the things that y'all are doing, which are vastly different. But I'm sure folks would like to hear what you do. And I know that Ira David Wood knows that bookkeeping is very important, even in running a theater.
Definitely. I also want to just say real quick, I want to acknowledge you for inviting me to the show. Thank you very much for having me on. And I'm sitting back here. I'm enjoying myself listening to David share his story, share his passion. It's, you know, even though it's you would think it's a lot different than what David does, you know, the bookkeeping aspect, the financial aspect, the way I see it, you know, I love entrepreneurship. I work with people who are like me, entrepreneurs at the core, and the numbers, they just tell a story. That's basically what it is. You know, I can read the story of a business from their financial reporting. It allows me to go in there, dig deep, and see, okay, what kind of struggles did this business have in the past? How did they overcome these struggles? You know, what do they have in it? What are they looking to do? And a lot of these small businesses, in their case, with these solopreneurs, people are just getting started out. They don't realize that keeping their books and doing the financial recording and reporting allows them to establish what that story is. So it's exciting for me to go in there and work with an entrepreneur. I usually work with small businesses, 1 to 10 employees, people that do under 2.5 in revenue. And I'm able to go in there, you know, talk with an entrepreneur, have that value conversation, and get in there and dive deep into what that story is, you know, and it's just exciting to me to do that. And yeah, it's important. People don't realize it's not just about telling the story, but it's about scripting and sculpting that story. It's about being able to achieve those things that you set out to achieve as an entrepreneur. You want to definitely create a different lifestyle. I know I'm an entrepreneur to the core, and one of the things is freedom. You know, we're built to be our own boss, but what does that look like? What trend are we setting? What value are we giving out there? That's all a part of it. Being able to understand what you're doing, what kind of impact you're giving to your stakeholders, your consumer base, the people who work for you and with you, and how do you just create from there? And to me, that's just awesome.
I appreciate it. So, Ira, if you would, talk about the importance of the business aspect to the theater and the park, and just the importance of business to you as well, because I know that y'all have been running for those many decades, so y'all have had to definitely come at it as a business from the business standpoint. So I would love to hear you talk about how important the business aspect is and the financial aspect of what you do is.
Well, too, I was listening to Cheston, and it sounds to me like what he brings to what he does is that special gift of creativity. And I think that makes any job less of a job and more of a joy. When you can be creative in what you do, and Chess, it sounds like you've got the key, man. You're approaching it just that way. Absolutely. But yes, theater is a business. You know, when you get down to it, you're selling a product, and the books. Oh man, you got to be an artist with the books, just like you're an artist on the stage. Particularly in times like these, when theaters are shut down. I mean, we're losing theaters in the Triangle area, which is a very sad result of what's going on. Mm-hmm. But again, it's like Chess says, you find a way to do it, just like we're going to do a virtual version of A Christmas Carol. You see what the need is, and you step in and find a creative way to fill it. I think that's, you know, that's what we do.
Yeah,
and balancing those books, baby. If they don't balance, that's it, boy. It's over right there.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And one of the things I wanted to hear from both of y'all is I know that with the other guests I've had, we've talked about what's going on in the education system. And I'm one of those people that believes that neither the arts or financial literacy are being taught enough in our school system. So I'd love to hear what y'all have to say about that. And I'll start with you, David, and then I'll hear from Cheston as well. But I'm just a big proponent of the fact that in order to develop critical thinking, a lot of the skills that you develop as an artist is also what you need in critical thinking. But I don't know that we're doing that great of a job if teaching it. And I know that you, in your early days, as you alluded to, were in public instruction. So I was just wondering how you think we're doing now in the sense of bringing arts and education together.
We need to do more than we're doing, I think. Art, theater, when you boil it down, it's communication. You know, and if you're lucky, that process of communication goes a level deeper and becomes what I call communion. It's almost a spiritual thing that happens when souls come together. And when that happens, when talent and work join together, you can expect a miracle because that's what you're going to get. I will say quickly, when I was younger working for the Department of Public Instruction, that there was some unrest in the Mecklenburg County schools. They were having racial tension. There was a lot of things going on. What the state did and the Department of Public Instruction did was put together a group of performers and sports stars, football players, basketball players, singers. And I got to be part of that group. And we went into the schools and got the whole student body together. We performed, we talked, and we were instructed to find the troublemakers and to call them out and to get people together. That's something that the arts can do. I mean, we're not just a dessert. We can be a main course. So, yeah, there's a lot more we can do.
I agree with you. And what about in terms of financial literacy? I know one of the things that they talk about here on IBM TV is the need for financial literacy. And I know that they're of the opinion that we don't have enough of that. So, Cheston, are you thinking that we're learning enough about financial literacy in the school system, or is this something like the arts that we can do a better job of and improve on?
I think we can always do a better job with financial literacy in the education system. You know, there are some schools that I know of that actually implement a pretty solid program with teaching, you know, some basic financial literacy understanding. My kids, for example, go to a school in New Jersey that offers a program that teaches them, you know, about financial statements, about, you know, stocks and about investing and about, you know, just basic fiduciary responsibility with your finances. But it's not enough because, you know, if it's not reinforced at home, for one, it's really not going to sink in. I think that's where it starts. And it starts in what we lay as an example for our children in the household. And it has to be something that's relatable to the person who's actually getting the education. You know, I know that the first time around when I went to school, you know, originally, I didn't go to school for finance. I didn't go to school for business. I went to, you know, I was good at math, and I knew that was the case. And people told me I should go into computers or science. So I went into computers, never ended up doing anything with it. And the reason is because, you know, at that age, when you're coming up, you really don't know what's out there for you in the world. You're just really having people tell you what to do. And it should be something where it's more engaging with the individuals that you're educating in that area. If they take it personal, if they take it on as an individual and sort of an engaging effort, then I believe that, you know, it would be something that would definitely benefit our young people today. You know, within the framework of getting out there as a young person after school, for me personally, it wasn't until I got into the real world that I realized that I needed to know some stuff, you know, especially since I realized I was built as this entrepreneur. I just started reading a lot of stuff on my own. And I think there's no problem with that. But at the same time, if we have that mentorship, that guidance and that leadership from the young ages in the educational system, I think we're a lot better off as not just, families, but as a community, as the country as a whole. Everybody's more, financially educated in that way.
I wish when we were going to school, I know when I graduated, walked out of that algebra class for the last time, I never used it again, but I type every day. I type, right. And I learned typing as a practical skill in school. I think these young people need to know about taxes, about voting, about all of those necessary things that you're actually going to do when you graduate, you get out into the real world. Because I think Cheston just hit the nail on the head. It's after you graduate that the education really starts. I mean, when you're out in the real world and you have to apply these ideas and dreams and make them work, that's where the education really comes in.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I agree with you on that. That's where the education comes in. Chester, I know that definitely David is over here in North Carolina, and he was telling me that he's pretty much staying at home, trying to stay safe. I forgot to ask you, how are you doing and where are you at? And also, how are you even getting around doing your financial work in this age of COVID? Because like, a lot of folks are struggling with that. So how are you getting around doing your work?
You know, I'm based out of North Carolina also. The company's based out of North Carolina. But I've been spending this whole year in Atlanta, Georgia, just for, family reasons and everything. I've been in Atlanta, Georgia. And, you know, with technology the way it is today, look at us. We're here having a conversation together. All of us sitting in our remote areas across the region, you know, and that's just basically what's available to us today to be able to go out and perform and almost not even miss a beat just because we have this technology available to us. You know, actually, before COVID hit, you know, I worked with my clients remotely a lot. You know, the Zoom platform that everybody uses is something that I had already been used to. You know, I believe that this time, this age that we're in, is really an opportunity, you know, to shift the landscape of how we do business with each other, to realize that there are really no limits to and boundaries to how we interact and create value for the people that we connect with. So, I've been able to really connect in a powerful way with the technology that is available to us now. And I'm glad we have it.
Yeah, definitely. David, how are you using technology? You've talked about what you're doing with Christmas Carol, but I imagine it's also how you're communicating with your actors. Also, I imagine it's also how you're doing rehearsals and things of that nature. So how are you working within this new age in order to get things done on a regular basis?
Well, we're getting ready to perform actually live stream a production. My son is directing it, but he started rehearsals in the Zoom format. And everybody got together.
That's awesome.
They've gone and had their tests, you know. When they get together tonight for the first time, they actually will come together safe distancing with the masks, and they start rehearsing together. They've all had their test. Boy, we got bathtubs of hand sanitizer and everything, you know, ready for them. But I do think, you know, through all of this, we're finding the ways to connect. I'm hearing from Cheston, too. It's that emotion that involves people, you know, and that's what makes a good teacher, too. Somebody that doesn't just stand there and emote facts that can be very boring, but you find a way to get people emotionally involved and to feel a sense of ownership in the process, I think, you know, which is what good theater does. So getting an audience reaction is a whole different ball game, you know, through video conferencing and these platforms that we're doing. But we're learning how to do it. So many theaters are finding ways into the hearts and souls and minds of the people who want that theater experience. So I think we may come out of this with some wonderful discoveries.
Yeah, I think we will. I think we'll learn some new things and come up with some great discoveries. Chester, I got a question for you. Early before you jumped on, David was talking about that he had the pleasure of actually getting to turn down Andy Griffith. So was there any kind of opportunity where you actually got to turn down somebody famous in your financial world? Because he had the opportunity to turn down Andy Griffith. I don't know how many people that get to turn down Andy Griffith, but David Wood did it.
No, unfortunately, no. Not yet. You know, like I told you, my background is in entrepreneurship. I've actually owned a few businesses in the past. I shifted into this one because it's my passion, and I've been involved with this since this time last year, you know, on a legitimate scale, you know, with the business and entity and everything set up. Before that, I was just helping out fellow entrepreneurs in my circle. So, no, man, I have not been able to turn down anybody famous yet. But if somebody famous does come across me, I believe that will be the case because, you know, I work with a very specific niche market. And I think that I'm effective working with that, you know, entrepreneur, that's a solopreneur, that person that's getting started within the first 5 years, that person that's has business volume less than 2.5 million. You know, I'm most effective in that area. So, yeah, I'll probably turn that down as well.
So you might have to get that opportunity too. Who knows? Maybe Chester will get an opportunity to turn down LeBron at some point or something like that. I don't know if he would actually do it or anything, but we'll see if LeBron comes to him with an opportunity or something that he can turn LeBron down for. So, David, you've talked about the importance of the arts and everything, and I've even seen the arts being very important in not just what's going on with the pandemic, but also in what's happening with BLM, with the Black Lives Matter movement, and a couple of other things. So I was wondering if you could also reflect on some of that, because I've seen some amazing artists that have done some amazing things with theater and other things that have talked about social issues as well and are using the arts to kind of address social ills. So I know you've done that, like I said before, with the Christmas Carol, but I also know that you're fans and supporters of others that are doing that work. So I'd love to hear your reflections on that.
Well, this has been an incredible opportunity for people involved in theater in the Triangle area to become closer through these virtual meetings. I get together with a group of theater friends once a week with no agenda other than to talk about what's going on. What have we discovered in a week's time? A lot can happen in 7 days. We are talking about what's going on in the world around us, the issues that theater needs to address, and to find a way to do that. So, you know, the best way I can describe it is a guy came into our theater lobby one night before the show and he passed me and he looked over at me and he said, "I hope I don't have to think tonight." And I looked at him, I said, "When did thinking become a painful process?" I said, "First of all, whatever the subject, you know, and it can be very dark, it can be very dramatic, but our first job is to entertain." You know, so the way to take a message of equality, equal rights, and to address that issue on a stage gives you a wonderful and a creative platform. Years ago, a local playwright wrote a play about hazing in a black fraternity. And we were going to do the world premiere at our theater. And during the rehearsal process, unfortunately, a young man died at a predominantly black university here in town because of a hazing incident. So a fraternity on campus heard about the play we were doing and thought we had put the play on because of what had happened to them. They showed up in front of our theater to picket the show. I was bringing lemonade out to them, And the head of the picket line turned to me and he said, "You don't understand, we're picketing the show." And I said, "No, you don't understand. 15 minutes ago, we had only one reservation. We're sold out now. You brought us some incredible publicity. And I'm going to tell you this, we're going to take this topic, as tragic as it is, we're going to put it on stage and give it a platform where people can talk about it when the show is over. We're going to discuss it. And I hope you will come and join us." They did. And it everything did a 180. So you can reach people like that. You can reach hearts. You can change lives. And, you know, that's our job, is to, as I said, to find that need in the in our community, because I think that's also important. Speak to what's going on right here and now. Address it. Talk about it. Give it a forum. So that's what good theater does. We want to be a main course, not a dessert. You know,
yeah, definitely a main course. I would agree with you on that. But both of you, what is some of your thoughts about where we are in society now? Because I know a lot of folks are thinking about the issues of the world, whether that's Black Lives Matter, whether that's Me Too, whether that's a number of other things. So if y'all could reflect on where you think society is and where y'all would like society to be. So I'll start with you, Cheston, and then I'll go with David. So where do you think society is and where do you think in your ideal world society should be?
Thanks, Mark. But first, I want to just acknowledge David, because, you know, he just went over the importance of creativity and expression and how powerful it is to, you know, change the scope of what people envision for a particular issue, whatever it may be. It's an opportunity to shift the paradigm of people who otherwise would not be shifted if they did not experience that expression that art gives us. You know, that is a great thing, a great tool. As far as, you know, where I see the world is today, you know, we're in tense times. You know, that's basically where we are. We're in tense times. And in these tense times, you know, there are people who are struggling. You know, I've come across business owners who are shutting down businesses because of, you know, this whole pandemic issue and what the economic landscape has done over the past 8 months. You know, people are scared to go out of their homes, you know, not just for the pandemic, but for what they're seeing on social media and regular media about, you know, the protesting and the violence. You know, as a African-American man, you with African-American children, an African-American son, you always have those conversations about, you know, what to do when you're confronted by situations with the police and how to treat them and how to present yourself. So that you come home. At the same time, I also see that, you know, when we get to these points as a nation, as a country, and now it's even as a globe, as a world, you know, we're actually primed for the change. I think that this is something that was inevitable. We were going to come to a position to where we can actually transform what we have come to know as how we treat one another in this world. And I think a lot of people are starting to see that. You know, there's a lot more people in the world that I believe show love rather than hate. And hate really can't last too long. You know, in my space, I believe a lot in the energy that I bring to the table and the people who come into my space bring to me. And I never really have an issue dealing with people because the energy that is within that space is one of creativity, love, and progress. And that's all I experience in my day-to-day endeavors. That doesn't diminish the fact that that's not what everybody is going through, you know. And being said, the space that I create is one that we can come together and provide solutions as people who are trendsetters. You know, I look at entrepreneurs as trendsetters. They actually established a trend by saying, "I'm going to be a business owner. I'm going to create a value out of nothing. I'm going to take an idea and I'm going to make it something that creates value, that actually creates a dollar for me and creates a job for another person." And then I start to build a community from there. So the people that are in my network are those people. And we come together to create ideas and organizations and networks to be able to make a difference. And it does start with economic influence and impact. And how can we do it in that way?
Definitely. And David, what's your thoughts about what Justin said and just where we are as a nation and as a world?
I think we're in a precarious situation. I think we're on the verge of a big change, and it's going to go one way or the other. I'm a big believer in history. I love history. History basically is the study of the lives of men and women who affected change in the past and, for the most part, made us better human beings. There were those who didn't, who made the world dark and a dangerous place. It's important to learn about all of those people that affected the change in our past, because unless we do, we're doomed to repeat the same errors that were made. Mm-hmm. I'm amazed at the number of young people, I think it was 30 or 40%, who have no idea what the Holocaust is, who Martin Luther King is, what African Americans in this country had to endure for 400 years. People are out of touch with that. I'm old enough that I can remember the white-only colored fountains, water fountains. I can remember those things. I can remember the Kennedy assassination, those watershed events that happened in our lives. We need to go back and really teach history. We're glossing over a lot of stuff right now. We need to go back and make sure the history that we teach these young people is correct. And I think that that's beginning to change. And I think that's one of the things that's going to come out of all of this. I know World War II veterans who are sitting around watching people march around with swastikas on flags. They fought a war to stop this. What is the disconnect here between these young people who have no idea what they're really doing? People downtown Raleigh walking around with weapons, you know? When this pandemic is over, I don't want to hear a word from those people because, you know, they talk about they couldn't stay in their homes 5 minutes to save the lives of their grandmothers. They had to, you know, get out on the streets. It's like, come on, people. How intimidated are you that you feel like you have to carry a weapon around? You know, that's a sign of fear, not power. And we have to address all of those things, and each one teach one, you know. I sometimes feel like I'm trying to describe the sky to a fish. You know, I got people in my own family that I'm going, I don't believe you believe that. I'm just having a disconnect here with you, you know. But what we have committed to do is to have discussion. And remember, too, in the Bible, the words to listen are used twice as much as the words to speak. Mm-hmm. I think we have to really listen to other people's viewpoints, and we have to kind of work our way into the discussion that way. So I'm hoping that's what good theater is going to be able to do, and I hope it's what entrepreneurs like Cheston and Mark, you and people who are out there hoping to make a difference. I hope we can do that in our own way. Each one teach one. We got a chance.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. And you're right. There's so much of history that isn't taught, unfortunately, because you were talking about the history and folks that don't know Martin Luther King or don't know Harriet Tubman or don't know Frederick Douglass. But then right here in Durham, there's a number of folks that have no idea who Pauli Murray is, no idea of the struggles of the various Native Americans and the various Latin American folks that were involved in different struggles. I mean, I know a lot of folks that probably don't even know who Cesar Chavez is and people along those lines. So it's a number of folks that we don't hear addressed in our history book. So I would agree with you on that, that that's something that needs to be addressed on a more regular basis. So if you could also, I'd love to hear both of y'all about the importance of entrepreneurship. And David, as far as I'm concerned, theater and what you're doing is a form of entrepreneurship. So I'll toss this one to you and then I'll come down to Cheston. But as far as I'm concerned, theater is a form of entrepreneurship.
Yes, it is. And I think, you know, when theaters spring up, it's because somebody has seen a need and just decided to step in and fill it. Sometimes it's what we don't know that makes us good. I just talked about how important education was, but sometimes not knowing what the, you know, the obstacles are, you just go, I get it done. I can start a theater. I can start a business. I can change the world. And I think theater is the way that I'm going to do it. I think you have to be bold with your dreams. I think you have to, you know, work in those primary colors, the bright colors. You have to spice up the food. You don't want a bland diet, you know, because if people get excited, they're more apt to listen because they want to hear and be a part of that dream. So that entrepreneurial spirit is vital to the creative process, because if you don't have that, you're not going to find a new way to communicate and to bring more people into the process, the learning process, because that's what we're all doing. Somebody said the other day, you know what life is? We're just walking each other home. And I thought, man, I like that. Yeah. We come together with our arms around each other and we walk in home. And when we do that, we all meet on the same level and we become brothers, you know, on a globe that's getting smaller every day. It's like the ghost of Christmas present says to Scrooge, the thing is to do the best you can with the time you have left on this earth to make a difference.
That's very true. Justin, what's your thoughts about entrepreneurship? And speaking of entrepreneurs, I just heard from one of the founders of IBM.TV, that being Kimberly Calhoun, and she definitely was saying that she was loving the conversation that we were having and everything. So she may have some questions that she'll ask from the comment space, but her and Nick Palveda are the ones that, along with others, that put this great network together. So he is watching from off on the side and seeing some of the conversation and is enjoying a lot of what we're talking about. So definitely, Justin, I'd love to hear from you about your thoughts on entrepreneurship.
Yeah, definitely. And thank you, David, for sharing what you just shared. You know, if we all thought that way, this world would be so much of a better place to be in every day. But, you know, I don't think everybody's built for entrepreneurship, to be honest. It's a rare breed, you know, and then the more I spend time with entrepreneurs, the more I realize it. You know, you really take that cap off of limitation by being an entrepreneur. You know, you're, like I said, you're a trendsetter, a trailblazer. You are charting into territory unknown, especially to yourself if you are getting started as an entrepreneur. You know, it's scary for a lot of people. But I believe the rewards for being an entrepreneur are second to none. You definitely get to have what I like to call is reach and impact. You can change lives on a mass scale. Zig Ziglar said your income is directly related to how many people you're able to help get what they want, get out of life. And that's what you are as an entrepreneur. You're looking to help people get exactly what it is that they want out of their lives. And their lives are everything that counts to you. You know, how can I be somebody that can be of service in that area? So the rewards are definitely there, both financially and you know, spiritually and emotionally and everything else. The thing is, you know, when you're taking on this role, this character as the entrepreneur, you got to be ready for the ups and downs that come along with it. I know that. You know, and I'm still going through this. And when I got started, you know, it's just learning, constant learning about your craft, your business, about what it takes to be somebody that, you know, somebody can call on to solve their issue. You know, you're a problem solver in multiple ways. You know, you have to be that person who's willing to not have the money come in the beginning. You know, whatever that may look like, you know, that's the scary thing for people. They're used to taking a paycheck. If you're going to a regular job, how can you step outside of that consciousness and move into that realm of, you know, I am the possibility, you know, and I can count on me to take care of everything that I want in life. You know, that's the idea. That's the concept of being the entrepreneur. You can definitely have power and move forward in life unlike anyone else. And personally, that's no, there's no other place I'd rather be than in that space. The good, the bad, and the ugly, I'm all in with it, you know, and I get to meet amazing people like, you know, you and David, Mark, on a regular basis. You know, this is just because it's my field. I can sit here and talk with a business owner, hear their story all day, every day, you know, and it's just a joy for me, you know, because I can relate. I can relate to everything that everybody goes through as an entrepreneur. I've seen it. I've done it. You know, I've had successes. I've had failures, you know, and I'm looking to look at everybody's successes and failures as an entrepreneur, because it's a family environment that not everybody can step into. So it's much appreciated. And it is what builds. It is what changes things. It is what makes the world what it is. It's the people who set the trends, the people who stand out, the people who want to, be on that path of entrepreneurship, that make the difference here in this world today. That's what I believe 100%.
Yeah, definitely would agree with you on that. David, a question I've got to ask for you and everything is, I know that your son is in the theater. I know that like I said earlier, your daughter is known throughout Hollywood and everything of that nature. What did you tell them when they told you that they wanted to follow in your footsteps and go back into the theater world? Because I'm thinking that you probably were going like, no, don't do that. Don't follow me. So when they both told you that they wanted to get involved in the case of your son, following in your footsteps, playing this very powerful role that you are going to turn over to him in a few years, and that you had to turn over to him when you got sick and when your daughter told you that you wanted to go all the way to that madness over there in Hollywood and everything. What was your reaction to that, and what did you tell them?
I have advice that I give every young person who comes to me with that same statement, you know, and it is this. If you want to be an actor, don't. If you have to be an actor, God bless you. Best advice I've ever gotten, and I give it to young people. It's like that great line from Jurassic Park, life will find a way. There's got to be something in you that just has to do it. You just have to do it. It's in your blood, you know. That's that old joke, you know. How do you get an elephant out of the theater? You can't. It's in his blood.
Wow. That's a very profound advice, and it sounds like you've given that to a number of folks. You've also had the pleasure of working with a lot of great folks. So I'd love for you to share some of those stories. I know that you have had the pleasure, and I've known him as well, and unfortunately he's passed on, but I know that you remember Papa Chuck Davis. You know a number of other folks that have gone on and everything. So I would love to hear you talk about some of the folks that were part of the legacy of your career as well. Like I said, I know that you definitely have referred to Andy Griffin. I knew that you've done work with Papa Chuck Davis. You've done work with a number of others as well. So I'd love to hear you just reflect on some of those great folks that we have lost that you had the pleasure of working with.
Well, we stand on the shoulders of so many people. People who've gone before, who blaze trails. There's a generation of performers in our area who were so vibrant and alive when I first came to Raleigh and decided this was going to be home. And they're gone now. And I look around and I go, the sad thing is so many people don't even know who they were. You know, again, it's knowing something about history. When you know, for instance, that actors at one time were denied Christian burials, you know that somebody earned you the right to go on the stage, earned you the right to have that business, earned you the right, Mark, to do what you do. That we stand on people's shoulders, you know. I had people who gave me incredible advice. I saw the movie Cyrano de Bergerac with Jose Ferrer. And I was not afraid to die after I saw that movie because of the way Cyrano faces death at the end. It was transforming for me. And I sat down and wrote Jose Ferrer a letter. And I told him that. I said, I want you to know, this is how what you did affected me. I am no longer afraid to die. I went to the School of the Arts. And that first year, I'd say, well, 3 months into the school year, phone rang on the hall of the dormitory and somebody picked it up and said, Wood, you got a call. I went down there. Hello? And this voice, beautiful voice, Ira David Wood, is this you? Yes, it is. Who's this? This is Jose Ferrer. So I am on the board of advisors of the North Carolina School of the Arts. I'm here in Winston-Salem. I'm two blocks away at a hotel. Would you join me? I think I was there before he hung up the phone. And I sat at that man's feet until, 2 o'clock in the morning, listening, soaking everything up I possibly could from this man who taught me how to lose my fear of death. And there were people like that. You know, those people cross our lives so many times. And what we have to be alert, we have to be alert to that moment in time and to take advantage of it. I think it's like Cheston says, you have to have that ability to step in and take advantage of the time. And listen, you know, just shut up and listen. So that's what I tried to do in meeting people. George Clooney. Now, most of these people I meet because my daughter is, you know, she's working with them. So I was lucky enough to go up and watch George Clooney direct Ryan Gosling and my daughter in a movie. And I'm standing watching George Clooney talk Ryan Gosling into the scene. It's a very dramatic scene. So when I'm sitting there watching, and they're at a table, underneath the table where Ryan couldn't see, Clooney had a water gun. And he was squirting Ryan Gosling's crotch with the water gun. So that when they finished and George said, okay, come on, let's do the scene. When Gosling stood up, it looked like he had wet his pants. And of course, everybody on the set fell out laughing, and poor, you know, Ryan had to go in with a hairdryer and dry his pants off. It's finding those people, you know, like I said, with a sense of humor to break up what might have been, you know, just a very deep, dramatic moment, to find a way around it, you know, to kind of shake yourself off, get rid of the tension, and go in and do a great job. So, yeah, the people that have crossed, I got to meet Laurence Olivier once. Wow. And that was like meeting God, you know, because he was my hero from day one. And my sister, who's in the Academy, invited me to go to the Oscars one year. And I was sitting there watching, you know, and they said, ladies and gentlemen, presenting the Academy Award for the best movie of the year, ladies and gentlemen, Lord Laurence Olivier. He walked out on stage and I just went, oh my God. And he was 2 days older than water. You know, I mean, beautiful man. And I turned to Carol and I went, and she said, okay, I know what you want to do. Cause I said, I got to meet him. When the credits rolled, you can see, cause we've got it on video somewhere around here. You can see two people running down the aisle, going up on the stage. This is no lie. I am elbowing Gregory Peck, Burt Lancaster, and Kurt Douglas out of the way to find Olivier. He's not on the stage. I look in the middle of the crowd, and there's Tommy Holtz, who was up that year for Amadeus. He played Mozart in Amadeus. Tommy and I went to school together. So I went over and gave him a big hug. I said, where's Olivier? He said, he's in the dressing room off stage. So get there fast because they're going to take him out to his limousine. So I said, right. Ran off stage, got to his dressing room. The door was open. I could see God sitting inside on a chair. Joan Plowright, his wife, was in there. There was a man in a tuxedo with a two-way radio in front of the door and two uniformed policemen on either side. But I figured nobody knows who I am. I just give it a shot. Now I walked up to the uniformed policeman. He said, may I help you? I said, I'd like to see Larry, please. He looked at me and he said, so what about half of the people in this auditorium? He said, but we're not letting anybody in. Said Gregory Peck is the only one we've let in. He was the producer this year. We're going to be taking Lord Olivier out to his limousine in a minute. So I said, well, I certainly understand. I stepped back, turned to my sister. I said, don't move a muscle, because the man got to come out this door and pass us on the way. So we waited, and all of a sudden the man in the tuxedo got a message on his walkie-talkie, and he looked down the corridor of the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, and he said, ladies and gentlemen, would you please make a path? We'd like to take Lord Olivier to his limo. Well, it was like the Red Sea parted. I mean, people just on both sides. He got up and started to walk out, and he was walking right in front of me, and I'm thinking to myself, if you don't do it now, it's gone. I reached out, and I touched his shoulder, and I just stroked his shoulder, and that man stopped and straightened up and did a slow turn. And as he turned to me, God turned sound down in the universe. I couldn't hear anything. And I just started getting flashes of all the characters that man had played. Richard III and Hamlet and Heathcliff and Wuthering Heights. And boom, 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 boom. And suddenly he was making eye contact with me. When he looked at me, it shot all the way down to my feet, back up again, and the hair on the back of my neck just stood out. And I couldn't say anything. I was just, you know, looking at him. And he looked at me suddenly, and he did this. He held his arm out. And I stepped in and took that man's arm in mine, took a breath, and he patted my arm, and we started walking down that corridor that in my memory stretched for miles. I'm passing these legends who are genuflecting as Olivier is going by, and I'm walking with them. I'm passing this Burt Lancaster, Gregory Peck, Kirk Douglas. Stevie Wonder was there. Stevie Wonder was standing by a payphone by himself, and I wondered, how did he get there? You know, what, Stevie, but you're walking with Olivier, so you can't stop and talk to Stevie. Got all the way out to the porte-cochere, and the limo was parked there. The driver came over to open the door, and I motioned him away. I helped Olivier in the car. I helped Joan, his wife, in the car. And then I realized I hadn't said anything to him. I said, I got to. So I stuck my head in the limousine. I looked at her, and I said, I just want to thank him. And Joan turned to him, and she said, Larry, this young man has something to say to you. And in my brain, I'm thinking, dear Lord, just let me put a verb behind a noun that's going to make a difference here. I couldn't think of anything to say, but he reached out, and I put my hand in his, and all I could say was, for everything you have meant to me and my life, and for what I know you will mean to generations to come, I thank you, and I love you. Tears came into his eyes. He reached out, put his hand on mine. Makes me emotional. Let's think about it. Wow. And he said, no, young man, you are tomorrow. You are my dream. God bless you. And I stepped back and closed the door, and the limo drove away, and I lost it. I just stood there and wept. And my sister came over, and she put her arm around me, and I said, honey, I'm flying back to Raleigh tomorrow, and I want you to know something. If the plane goes down, do not grieve, because I have walked on the mountaintop tonight. I got to tell that man that I loved him, and I got to thank him, and that meant everything to me. So that's my story.
Wow, an amazing story, no doubt about that. But, you know, you bring up an interesting point, because I know for years I've been going down to Winston-Salem to the National Black Theater Festival. And a lot of times there'll be celebrities there, and folks are oftentimes wondering how they can approach these celebrities. And some of these are you know, A celebrities. I remember when Ruby Dee and Ossie Davis were there, but then there are also B and C celebrities, and if you want to put those kind of rankings on them. But even those celebrities, a lot of times folks will not want to engage them in conversation, and me and some other associates will go and talk to them, and a lot of times they would be, some of your friends will be amazed that you went up there and talked to, like, a Phyllis Dickney or somebody like that. And I'll be like, look, they are just folks like anybody else. And a lot of times that's the way you have to approach them. And they actually appreciate that. I know I've actually sat down with some folks that are in that kind of like fear, whether it's folks like Woody, I'm trying to think of Woody's last name, but he's like a major director out of New York, or some other folks that, along those lines. But they are glad to have folks that will sit down with them and engage them in conversation. They don't always want people to put them on those pedestals. And I'm sure that you even get that sometimes yourself, David, here, where folks want to put you on a pedestal and you just want them to have an engaging conversation with you.
Yeah. And I find, you know, that's very true, Mark. It's like, you know, they love to talk about hobbies and fishing and, you know, the things that they do. It's also knowing when to approach them. You know, I think that's very important. Yeah. It's a great story about Paul Newman. He used to fly into Wilson, North Carolina. There were friends there, and he'd go fishing. They'd go river fishing, and they used to go back and cook the fish that they caught. Yeah, you know, just sit around, have a few beers, and eat the fish. So one trip down, he came back, and he said, listen, tonight, let's don't cook the fish. Let's go out to a little fish fry cafe, and let's just eat. And then we don't have to worry about prepping the fish and cleaning them and all that. And they said, well, Paul, all right, you know, we'll do that, but, you know, you might be recognized. He said, nobody's looking for me at a fish fry cafe in North Carolina. He's got a ball cap on and he had a mustache and a beard. So they all went to this little fish fry place outside of Wilson, and they went to the table in the far end and sat there and ordered. Boy, they were having a feast. And one of the guys looked way down at the other end of the restaurant. This lady was giving it this, looking. The guy looked over at Paul and said, Paul, I think you've been spotted. He said, all of a sudden, the lady got up and started walking towards the table, and they were all there. Guy said, yeah, Paul, here she comes. I think she spotted you. She got to the table, and she looked at Paul Newman, and she said, I know you. Paul Vila, I watch your show every day. Bob Vila, I watch your show every day. And asked for his autograph, and Paul Newman took that piece of paper and signed it, Bob Vila, and gave it back to him. It's one of my favorite stories.
That's a great story. Justin, what advice would you give to not just entrepreneurs, but when you talk to entrepreneurs, have you had some entrepreneurs that have influenced you? And who are some of those entrepreneurs? And have you had the pleasure of meeting any of them? So are there some entrepreneurs that have inspired you?
Yeah, I would say every entrepreneur I speak with inspires me in some way, shape, or form, whether they're just brand new into their industry or somebody who's been around for decades. I'm always gaining some value out of those conversations and being influenced in some way. You know, if I were to, you know, pick a couple of people who influenced me to a great degree, you know, I used to work for a guy when I was in my early 20s, had a small security company. And at the time I was doing some graveyard shift work with him in security and, you know, building a real estate business. And he just took me under his wing, you know, and mentored me in some of the aspects of business that he knew. And I really appreciated it. And, you know, from that mentorship, I think it really did put me on the path to stay on an entrepreneur journey. You know, that was something I can never, ever forget. You know, some of the people that you come across on this journey, they definitely impact you in a tremendous way.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And are there any like famous entrepreneurs that you had the pleasure of actually learning from? Because I know a lot of folks are thinking about like the Les Browns and the folks of that nature. So I was wondering if there were any of those or Napoleon Hill that have influenced you as well.
Absolutely, all those guys. You know, you know, read and watched and heard a lot of these individuals. You know, like the Napoleon Hill's Les Brown, Zig Ziglar, Robert Kiyosaki, a local guy here in Georgia. You know, with the Rule One book. But there's so many different people along the way that I have been able to glean a lot of information from. One of these books that I read way back in the day was a guy from that wrote a book called Wealth Without Risk, Charles S. Givens. It's a very dated book today, but I remember reading that book in the late 90s and thinking about, man, there's a whole world here of information that I don't think anybody really has access to. You know, most people, I think, play the game on the other side of it, on the bench side of it. They're just kind of sitting there in the stands, not really understanding what it takes to get on the field. This guy had answers on how to get into the field and play the game on a higher level, be it from just a tax perspective, making sure that you're not exposing yourself so much in taxes, or just little strategies here and there to gain interest on your money over time. So, you know, I definitely have done my share of reading and taking advice from those types of individuals that have left a trail for me to follow.
That's a great trail to be following. What advice would you give to folks that want to be entrepreneurs? Because I know a lot of times folks think they want to be entrepreneurs, but then they don't necessarily have the wherewithal to do it. So what advice would you give to folks that say that they want to be entrepreneurs?
If they really want to be entrepreneurs, I would say just take action, be powerfully in action. Like if you are somebody who's afraid of the risk that it takes to be an entrepreneur, there are ways to take action now so that you're not exposed to certain risks. You can put aside a certain amount of savings, knowing that the one day you're going to take that money to start the business that you want to start. You can talk to somebody like me, get a free consultation from somebody who understands what it takes to get into some type of business, and learn from that experience. Take notes, record the meeting, start building a network. A lot of people don't even understand what it takes to capitalize a business. You know, you have access. You know, it's not about having the resources available. It's about being resourceful. You do have access to certain ways to generate income, generate cash flow, and generate capital in the way of your family and your friends. Hey, look, I got a business idea. What do you think about it? Would you like to partner with me on it? And just start those conversations. When you get beyond that phase, you want to definitely educate yourself on the craft and the industry that you're getting into. Understand what it takes to be successful in that industry, you know, what the market is, what kind of prices you can charge for what you want to do. And then you want to make sure that as you start that business, you have your team available, you know, your accountants, your lawyers, your advisors, people that have your back. You know, I like to be one of those people for the people that I work with in that space, you know, and I'm definitely open to the idea of building a mastermind, a brain trust to help anybody be able to do what it is that they want to do. I think the key is to realize that there are no limits in that yet. It's only limited by your ability to get out of your own way and start taking those actions. Whatever small action you can take right now to make it happen, do it. Take it. It's worth it.
Yeah, because one of the things that I'm finding is that we're seeing more and more people that are deciding to become entrepreneurs because of what's going on and because of their own economies, their personal economies haven't been impacted. So many people have been laid off from jobs, and now they're trying to find ways to create new jobs. And some of those jobs are in the entrepreneurship field. So are you finding that in your research as well, Cheston? Because I'm seeing that a number of folks are being laid off. They're being furloughed, unemployed, and now they're thinking that now is the time for them to start that garden that they always wanted to do and monetize it, or start that bakery that they've always wanted to do and monetize it. So is that something that you're also seeing as well?
Yeah. Sometimes like these situations are just the catalyst somebody needs to make that jump. I'm seeing that a lot. I'm also seeing, you know, spike up, you know, like your Ubers and your Lyfts and your side hustles like, you know, your DoorDash and your Instacart. All these people are jumping into these little side gig areas, which are generating some income as a self-employed individual. I get it. I would say that people who do those gig jobs or the gig kind of self-employed work, make sure they understand like what their exposure is when they're making that money too. It's a little bit different, like moving from an employee mentality to, you know, that gig work mentality. You know that you're going to be making some money in that area, but you don't really know how you're going to be impacted with taxes and other things. You know, so you want to make sure that you're you know, taking your mileage. You want to make sure that you're keeping your receipts and actually have some type of real bookkeeping system in place to track exactly how much you're spending out in order to produce that income. You'll be surprised at how thin your margins are after the fact. You know, did you really make money? You know, after all is said and done. You know, I've also had, you know, friends and clients that have transitioned businesses, you know, because the way that their business was operating before COVID wasn't sufficient to keep the business going through COVID. So it wasn't necessarily a bad thing for them because they had ideas about starting other businesses that were more so their passion than the current business they had. So they stepped out of that. I mean, it was a real excuse to get into, you know, the focus mode and building out an online business, you know, something that they were passionate about, how to reach more people. So, yeah, I'm seeing that a lot. And what I would say is that even though times seem like they're getting hard, there's always a way to shift and pivot and make an opportunity out of a somewhat seemingly drastic situation.
Yeah, but I would definitely agree with you on that. Justin, if you would, if you tell folks how they can reach you. And by the way, I was strolling earlier, theaterinthepark.org with the RE. You'll be glad that I did the RE, David, so the folks can learn about how to reach you and everything. But Justin, how can folks reach you? And I'll put that on a banner as well. So let folks know how they can reach you, and we'll create that banner so that folks can learn about what you're doing and everything.
Yeah, you can reach me at www.buythebooksconsultants.com.
So it's buythebooksconsultants.com.
Yep.
That name. How did you come up with that name and everything?
It's funny because, you know, I like to be above board in what I do, you know, kind of overdo it. And it was a funny thing among the friends that I had when I was in my other businesses. You know, I wanted to make sure things got done right. You know, and, you know, I went back to school and got a finance degree and everything. And, you know, in one of the areas of business I became proficient at was that whole financial reporting and bookkeeping, and then reading the numbers and telling people what that meant in that whole space. So, you know, people would joke me, man, you don't break any rules, do you? I was like, nah, why am I going to put myself at that type of risk? You know, so I came up with the name By the Books because it kind of reflects exactly, you know, the nature of how I am. You know, everything is kind of by the books. You know, so when you get me, I'm gonna find a way to get it done within the framework where it's gonna make sure you're okay.
That's really good. That's great. That's great, Chester.
But both of you, if that actually comes down to even like the concept of branding, and I know branding is something that a lot of folks think about regularly, and both of you managed to come up with what a lot of folks would be surprised at, because you got some branding that is, in a lot of ways, very basic. Because if you think about it, it's By the Books Consulting. A lot of folks would probably be like, I can't even go with that name because there's probably another By the Book somewhere in the world. But you went and you found it, and apparently you're the only one there. The same with Theater in the Park. I mean, most folks would be like, there's got to be, you know, with all these parks in the world, there's got to be some other theaters in the park. But you were actually able to get it and everything. So both of you could talk about the importance of branding and also how you managed to get these brand names that are, to the most part, very basic, but also you managed to get them, and a lot of folks would probably be amazed that you have these websites, because a lot of folks probably already assuming that other folks have them.
Yeah, I'll speak to that. You know, it's simple as just doing your research. The idea comes to mind, you write a list down. You know, I had a few lists of names. It wasn't necessarily the first name that came up that was available to me, but yeah. Yeah, you do your research, search online, see whether or not it was available. I was fortunate, you know, to have it actually work out. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, divine intervention. It's supposed to be, right? Yeah. It was designed to be for me, so it's for me. I'm not worried about it anymore, you know, so I grab it up and take it. That's just a simple way about it.
And what about you, David? Was it just divine intervention some 45 or 50 years ago that helped you get this? Or were you just already going to be determined that you were going to have that name and everything?
Well, when we started out, we called ourselves Stage 73, 1973. and then Stage 74. And I said, well, you know, we're going to be changing our name every year. We need to find something and settle on it. Pick a hair color. We were a theater. We were in the park. So that was very simple. The only throwback to that is we will occasionally get telephone calls from people who are new in the area or haven't been to our theater to go, are y'all inside or outside? Because you said we're in the park. You don't say we're inside in the park. So we explained to them, and, you know, that's the only throwback about being theater in the park is just inside or outside.
Inside or outside. And it doesn't help that there is another theater here in the area that actually has an outside as well. So that probably confuses folks as well, because I know that there is Raleigh Little Theater, which has that amphitheater outside where they sometimes do some stage productions that would probably add to the confusion. And the fact that there would have to be, I think, another space that might have some theater space as well that's going to be in a park area, because I want to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the plans for Dorothea Dix to have like some performance space there as well? So
absolutely,
the confusion as well.
Yeah, because we have a lot of theater organizations that don't have a space. So that is one of the plans about the Dix property, is to have some kind of space that companies who need, you know, a performance space can go in and utilize. And that's going to be a big blessing for a lot of people.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be a big blessing. If you would, David, talk up, and you've referred to it a couple of times, but you're right. A lot of our theaters are struggling. I know that there have been some theaters that have gone under. I know there have been some small businesses, including some that were very well known, like Morgan Imports and some others. So if you could talk about how the kind of future of theater is right now, because I know that because of all that's going on, and particularly with the pandemic, these have been very difficult times, particularly for our small theater. So when you're meeting with your fellow theater folks, how are y'all visualizing the future and how are y'all maintaining survival?
We're fortunate in that Christmas Carol has enabled us to put money in the bank against a rainy day. And boy, this has been a deluge. I mean, so we did have money set aside that's enabled us to continue. All of us on staff at Theater in the Park are furloughed for 1 week a month. We've all done that voluntarily to help the theater save a little money and to, you know, enable us to continue on. I think the determining factor, as it always is with theater, is going to be the audience. And I think one of the things I'm hearing from so many people, I call them Ralph and Rhoda, by the way. Our audience, I refer to them as Ralph and Rhoda Raleigh, because they know what they want, and it's our job to provide it to them. But one of the things that I'm hearing from Ralph and Rhoda is that they, all of a sudden, having to be without live theater, are beginning to see how much it meant to them when they did have it and didn't realize its value and its worth to their lives. Without the arts, this isolation period we're going through would be horrendous. You know, without music and drama and, you know, being able to, I've told everybody, look, I've gone through Netflix. I've done Netflix now. I've seen everything, you know, but it's letting the audience suddenly see, boy, it is important. It is important to the fabric of our lives to have the arts, you know. So what we're seeing is that our audience members are saying, I want a season ticket. I'm still going to buy a season ticket. I think we can count on one hand the number of people who have asked for refunds this year. And people are saying, look, I usually buy 10 tickets to a Christmas Carol. I'm going to buy those 10 tickets this year by giving you the money I would have spent on those 10 tickets. And please keep it going. And when you know you've got that love from, you know, the public, it's like, thank you. That's water in the desert. That means we can continue a little longer. And so my advice to people is support the arts any way you can. I mean, make those donations. you know, find out how you can help. Because, you know, they call theater, it's always been called the imaginary invalid. You know, we die on the stage every night. We're reborn the next night. But this is, these are tougher times than I've ever seen. And, you know, not just for theater, but for businesses everywhere, restaurants. I mean, you know, I'm living for the day I can say the words or hear the words. Would you like to start a tab?
Yeah.
You know, I haven't heard those in a long time. And, you know, that's going to be another problem, too. When we are finally able to go out to bars again, you know, people are going to be looking at the bartenders going, is there alcohol in this? Because nothing is going to match the rocket fuel I'm pouring here at home, you know, while we're all, we're looking to the audience, you know, to that continued support. Theater has been there when they've needed us, and now they need to be there when we need them. You know, it's one of those things. So,
definitely. I can understand what you're saying. I've got a cheese chest and everything. You're hearing all this talk about theater. You're definitely an entrepreneur. I want to know, have you ever tried to get into the world of theater, and are you ready for David to direct you?
You know, in eighth grade, Midsummer Night's Dream.
Whoa! All right.
Was it Oberon, right? Oberon was the character.
Jump back, Chester. Your stock just went up in my book, buddy. That's a roll.
Yeah, but I think that was the extent of my acting career. Just like eighth grade drama. Yeah. I definitely have an appreciation from that point on. You know, I love to be entertained by the arts, theater arts, especially, you know, movies and everything else. I love to be captivated, and I can appreciate everything that David stands for and embodies in that, you know, because it is vital. It's important. I think it's where people spend their money is reflective of that. You know, we spend a lot of money in this country. I think the most money that people spend is in that area, you know, to get away, to escape, to actually understand and be intrigued by what the creative arts bring to the table. It's definitely life-changing.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And I'm going to flip the script and turn it to David. So, David, do you have any role for any bookkeeper accountant over there at the theater? Or is there anything coming up that he might need just his qualifications for?
If that man played Oberon, he can just come in and name what he wants to do.
I might pick you up on that, David.
Anytime, Cheston. Anytime, buddy.
Sounds like some good conversation there, some possibilities and everything. But we get ready to wrap up the show, and I do appreciate both of y'all for being on. But before we get off the air and everything, one of the things that we always do at the end is we give folks a chance to reflect and give some message of hope. So, like I said, you know, I've done a lot of that during the course of the day. But if there's any other words that you'd like to share in terms of a message of hope for those that are going through so much this day, whether it's the economic crisis that we're all in the middle of, whether it's what's happening with the pandemic, whether it's things that are going on, like I mentioned before, with BLM and the Me Too movement, but just any kind of words of encouragement that you can give to our global audience, you know, that they may want to carry with them. So I'll start with you, Chester, and then I'll come up to David, because I know David's going to give me a whole story, and I love those stories, so I'll start with Chester first. So, Chester, what words of encouragement would you give us?
I would say stay tuned into more so of your own intentions. There's a lot going on with the media, you know, and you know, the news hardly ever changes. It's always, you know, around the same thing, mostly negative. And you'll be able to get the news from your neighbor, right? So I would say tune more into your intention. What I mean by that is, like, what are you going to be up to? You know, you do have power. Everybody is given a measure of power to take control of their own existence. All right. It's about being able to hone and focus everything that you have on what it is that you want out of life. When you have that focus and that attention there, then, I mean, infinite opportunities open up to you. All right. You can take action in whatever realm you want to take action in, if it's aligned with your intention, and you'll find the resources available to help you not only stay through this time, but come out on the other side much better because of it. I believe that 100%. So just stay focused on what you want and what you want to create out of this world. And then from there, direct all your energy and focus on taking powerful action on becoming that, you know, whatever your intention may be.
Sounds good. David, I know you've got some words of great thought and everything that you want to share with the audience. So I'd love to hear what you've got to say that can be encouraging to the global audience that watches, because I know we've got folks that watch as far away as Malaysia, South Africa, Australia, and a number of other places, because even some of the producers here are from those countries. So anything that you want to share to the global audience as well as the folks here in the United States?
I gave my daughter some advice when she started working in the movies. One of her first breakthrough movies was the movie 13, and it was a tough movie for her to do. It was very emotional. And I said, "Honey, you know it's pretend, and I know it's pretend. It's what we do, but your body doesn't. You know, if you make yourself laugh, you make yourself cry, you make yourself get angry, your body goes through all of those emotions. You have to remember to take a walk in the grass." And that's become our catchphrase. And what that means is you have to find something to restore your soul, particularly during these times. We wake up in the morning, it's so easy to fall into a rut. You know, we don't know what day it is. It's, you know, October the 92nd. You know, I mean, we've lost track of all of that time. And I think it's just what Cheston said. You know, you've got to take action. You've got to step out of that rut. And sometimes that means walking in the grass to help you find some equilibrium and regain some perspective. If that means sitting on your patio and listening to some music, or listening to the birds, or reading that book you've always wanted to read, or just zoning out, you know, find that equilibrium, your sea legs. Because right now we're on a boat that's moving like this. Every day something different is happening. And it's finding that way to balance on that boat with the sea legs that keeps you level. And that's important. And sometimes it's the hardest thing to do. One other key that I use in my theater all the time, and it's the we call them the ball butts. Ball butts. I have a little basket of little tiny, like, ping pong balls. When we're sitting around talking about projects and what we want to do, and you'll hear people go, "Yeah, you know, we could do that, but." As soon as you hear the "but," we pick up a ball and throw it at the person. Stop with the buts, because the buts are those hurdles you put in front of yourself. You know, "Oh, I could do this, but." Take the butts out. Get rid of the butts, you know, and clear the way for you to do what Cheston said, which is take that action that's going to change your life and then change the lives of everybody you come in contact with. Now we'll turn in our hymn books to page 93 and close out with a hymn, Mark, okay?
Sounds great. As always, David, you are an amazing theatrical performer and just an amazing individual. I'm glad to call you a friend. I've known you for a while. Glad to call you a new friend, Cheston. So definitely glad to have both of you on this show. And it's been a great and engaging conversation. I'm going to actually bring up a couple of shows that we air here on IBM.TV. And hopefully y'all will stick around and I can holler at y'all after we do the end broadcast and everything. But I'm getting ready to bring those up as well as the closing, which is also the intro outro. So get ready to do that. But if y'all stick around, and then we'll end the broadcast. But y'all have been some amazing guests, and I want to thank both of you for being on. And I hope that I can get both of you back on at a future date as well, because I think folks learned a lot. They definitely got to laugh a lot, and they got to be in having some engaging conversation. And that's what we're all about here on IBM.TV. So I want to thank both of you for being my guest on this particular afternoon.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you, Oberon.
Thank you, David. Great meeting you both.
Pleasure. All right.
We'll be right back.